You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is a podcast from stuartgoldsmith.co.uk.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode one of the Comedian's Comedian. My name's Stuart Goldsmith. I'm a stand-up comic. And that's an attempt already not to say the word comedian any more times than we absolutely have to, given the title. I'm a comedian. It's great. And I've been doing it for about 7 years. And something I've realised is that I have never done any official training in comedy. Some comics go on a course when they start off. A lot of people do. A lot of people don't. I just realised that I was working full-time in a profession for which I'd received no training at all. So my initial idea with this show was it wasn't going to be broadcast. It was just going to be almost a masterclass where I would invite comedians who I love and think are great and think I could learn something from and maybe go and organise almost a gig whereby they could talk to other comics of my level or sort of similar and tell us how they do it. And it would be like training. It would be like boot camp. I think that would be a great idea. I still do. So if anyone's interested in doing that, get in touch with me. But I approached a couple of people and they all said similar things, which was that, God, no, I don't have any methodology. I don't have anything that I'd be prepared to deliver to people. And I just sort of thought, although they might think that, that can't really be true. I mean, everyone has a way of doing things that to them just seems really obvious and not worth mentioning. But it's them. It's uniquely them. And there are certain rules I follow when I'm writing jokes or trying to. And also, I'm interested in how people make a life for themselves. Once you get to the stage of being paid full time, that's the first main goal, is to get paid. The second main goal is to get paid full time. And then the third goal is what? It's just out there. It's like, what, massive, you know, the sky's the limit with this industry. So massive TV success or whatever. You've got to also get more realistic goals along the way. Now, a decent goal, I think, is to get better. So this show is really just an attempt for me to grab individual comics and get them to tell me who they are and what they do, and more specifically, how they write. I'm not so interested in this show in the why, although we will talk a bit to each person about how they got started. But what I'm really interested in getting a grip on is each person's unique style. And you can use the word methodology if you want. That's not a great word. It's a bit of a scary word. I quite like the way it sounds, but it's a bit hoity-toity. Really, I'm just trying to find the things that comedians take for granted in how they write their own stuff. Sort of on the basis I try and share it with the world, and also sort of so I can learn from it and try and get better at comedy. So that's the point of the show. This is episode number one, and it's with Rob Deering, who's an excellent comedian, someone I'm really excited by. I'm doing an initial series of six, I think, for this run, and I've tried to pick people who have contrasting styles, but also people who I think have an intelligence to their comedy, something that suggests they really think about it. But equally, we'll also be talking to people who are trying to get away from thinking about it and being more natural and spontaneous. So Rob is guest number one. And he's just brilliant. I don't want to sort of sing his praises now, much as I love him, because you're about to listen to him for an hour. And it is an hour. I could have made it shorter, but I don't know the first thing about editing. I'm sort of learning on the go. So at the moment, it's staying an hour. I sort of think this is the sort of podcast I would like to listen to whilst driving to gigs and back from gigs. And frankly, there's a lot of road hours need using up. So if it seems too long and unwieldy in the future, I'll try and cut it down. Perhaps you could email me at info@stuartgoldsmith.co.uk, Stuart with a UA, and tell me your feedback on the show and how long you think it should be and where you think the apostrophe should go. I mean, come on, is it the comedian belonging to the comedians or a comedian belonging to a comedian singular? So it's very confusing. So, so this is Rob. This is his thing. We are going to talk about all sorts of stuff. We're going to talk about his process, about how he circles around an idea, how he inspires himself to improvise, the moments that that I would call sort of instigating crisis on stage deliberately so that you have to come up with something. But it's interesting talking to Rob and hearing how he would phrase ideas that I think are probably similar between us very differently and think about them with a whole different mindset. So we're going to be talking about his musical comedy as well, and also how you cope with being a comedian. So that's the score. And I should say as well, this is filmed. The first two episodes of this series are filmed. They're not filmed. I think I say on the second one that it's filmed. It's not. So when you get to the second episode, don't write in, because clearly you've not listened to this bit. They're both recorded before a live studio audience at the Top Secret Comedy Club. Which is a brilliant comedy club in Covent Garden. So many thanks to Mark Rothman for letting us record there. And this is filmed before... It's not filmed! This is recorded before an audience, which I should say is very, very small. They're an extremely small audience, and but they were warm and willing, and they gradually grew larger throughout the show. I think that's all I have to tell you. I hope you enjoy it. And here it is, episode one.
Hello.
So, welcome to the podcast. Welcome you, the listener. I'm told you need to refer to the listener as an individual, don't you?
Well, I can perceive the listener as an individual.
Can you perceive them now for us?
It will take a minute.
Yeah. So thanks for listening to this. Thanks for downloading this and other things that I will probably put on afterwards.
Put some trousers on, for goodness sake.
Yes, there it is. It's a radio joke. We are both naked. Welcome. Rob Deering is a comedian that I've worked with on several occasions, and mm-hmm. you were someone who I worked with when I was very new, sort of five or six years ago.
Well, I was going to say, work with is all well and good, but what we really did is the comedian's apprenticeship, which is our first gig together, was really far away.
Yes, it was.
So by the time we'd driven there and back, we'd not only found out each other's life stories, but we'd also had a number of really quite interesting adventures.
We did. Interesting adventure number one. The first thing you need to understand about our trip to, it was Swansea wasn't it?
Swansea, yep.
Was right. Unusually in the world of comedy, Rob was doing the driving. It's normally down to the newer act to do the driving, but I was quite taken aback, and Rob said, hey man, I'll drive, I've got a nice car. Mm-hmm. Those might not have been your exact words, but you did have a nice car.
Yep.
And so Rob drove us to Swansea, and I thought, hey, but that was an incredibly nice and unnecessarily nice thing to do. And then on the way there, the two key things I remember were that you said, Rob, it should be said, is an incredibly voracious consumer of culture. You love stuff that is made by people.
That's true.
And you have an opinion on anything,
yes,
and everything, and your opinion is immediately contactable. Rob Deering, how do you feel about Harry Potter?
I love it.
There
fantastic.
You see, it's as quick as that. But you said to me, why don't you play me some of your tunes? And so I played on my iPod through your car stereo maybe as many as four or five different tunes that
different
I
artists,
thought were
different albums,
wildly different.
Theoretically, quite diverse stuff.
Yeah, theoretically. and then you said to me, judging from those, you like this kind of music, these kind of films, these books, and you named authors and movies. And I went, oh my God.
Me too. My blood sugar was probably low. If I skewered your whole taste in
no, but
culture.
You did. I mean, you didn't so much skewer it as just sort of go, this is exactly what you like, and you absolutely nailed it. Wow. Based on the basis of what I thought was some really, you know, eclectic. Hey, I'm into all kinds of. Hey, there's a bit of They Might Be Giants. And there's a bit of Death Cab for Cutie. They're the same thing. Oh, fair enough. Okay.
yeah,
that was lovely. And then
on the way back, when we left the petrol station, I got into the car, briefly put my snacks and wallet on the roof of the car, and then we drove away, and then we had to go back and pick up all of those things.
Yes, it was. We'd gone about 2 miles, and you said, can you pass me my cookies? And I went, you didn't give them to me, mate. And you went, no, I did. And we were driving along, and we both had that moment of joint realisation of, well, if they're not there, then they must be on the route behind us.
And it was a really good adventure, because we had to come off at the next junction, go back to the services, find a way over the motorway, drive around a gate and through a ditch, up a no-entry road into the back of the garage. And then there was a brilliant kind of Hansel and Gretel trail. And they went in terms of lightness and importance. So first of all, near the pumps, there were some Snacker Jacks. Great, found those. Oh, a bit further on, is that a pasty or a sandwich?
Yeah.
And then right on the flipping chevrons onto the M4, you got out and got it, was my wallet, which had been run over. Yeah. But it was still full of money, and you got it back.
Yeah, there we go.
Come on.
Come
still
on.
Pretty pleased with that.
There it is. That, for the listener, that was a high five. I'd like to talk to you about lots of things to do with comedy, and something you mentioned when you came in, and I said, hey, we'll talk about that, and you went, will we? Is the lifestyle of a comedian and how you cope with it. Something I was considering saying at the beginning of this podcast is that if regular listeners to the podcast, if it becomes a regular thing, and I hope it does, might be able to sort of listen back to the questions I'm asking and paint kind of a picture of my neurotic approach to comedy. So I wanted to open with a question like, Rob, how on earth do you cope with the insane isolation of comedy?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes down to it, I don't know, this is definitely me rather than everyone else, but I think that ultimately in comedy I trade off the kind of core social group that real people have for a rather wider social group that is everyone.
Yes.
I.e. all comic audiences anywhere, plus people off Facebook and people off Twitter. I don't know if I just imagine that, and I don't know if maybe everyone thinks, well, I've only got two friends, but everyone else has got loads of friends. And maybe as you get older, you know, obviously you can only really count as your friends the people you get time to spend time with.
We should say, for the benefit of non-comedians, I mean, most of you, I think, but perhaps people listening at home won't know comedians socially, but it's a kind of a bizarrely, it can be a very bizarrely isolating job, because you work different hours to everyone else, and it's very difficult to have a relaxed Sunday on a Wednesday.
That's right. You can't do it, because everyone knows the days of the week, they stay the same no matter what you do. And yet, on the other hand, you've got old friends and you say, it's on Saturday in 3 weeks, so will you come? And you say, no, of course I won't. I work Saturdays.
I mean, I found when I started comedy, it was kind of cool for the first couple of years to go, oh, no, I can't come to your birthday because I've got a gig.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 3 years down the line, they don't ask anymore because they assume you've got a gig.
And I quite happily, in turn, will be at a gig and then have a drink with some strangers who I'll never see again. And you think,
do you do that? I never do that.
Yeah, no, I do that.
I think that is healthy. That's healthier than it sounds.
I don't know. I mean, it is that thing. It depends how much you're trying to soak up the joy of being the kind of guy on stage, you know, because when it comes down to it, when you first meet someone off stage, you say, yeah, it was really great, and you go, thanks very much, and then you're the guy off stage. But if you stay, I don't know, it only takes, I would say about 8 minutes.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're just strangers talking to each other.
Absolutely.
And that does not carry the same magic at all.
No,
and then some
acts are really good at that, though. I think some acts can come off and go, hey, I mean, I heard a story about an act who will remain nameless, who came off stage after bantering
with
a group of
young guys.
That's going to
really knacker his or her career, though, isn't it?
What's that?
Them remaining nameless. Always working.
Always. but he came off stage and said to a group of people he'd been bantering with, so where are we going? Do you know what I mean? And it's just, that's like awful.
Yeah, that's...
I'm so passionate that I don't want to be that. So normally, when I come off stage, I'll go, right, that's me, and I'll get the hell out as soon as I can.
Yeah, I would go down the middle. You see, I'd like to extend, and this is true in my sort of body of work in comedy, I like to extend it. I'd rather talk to... That's why it's nice. I mean, for all the kind of... career progression of doing things like, you know, sort of the TV things that we can do, like talking about things or being on panel games. I like them because you get to be your stand-up self off stage and off script.
Yes.
And I like that to get as far as it can towards my day-to-day life. So, you know, so talking to people I don't know is part of it for me.
Yeah.
Where even on the internet in the middle of the day.
you're quite a prolific Facebook user as well.
Yeah,
I think you and Paul Sinha are the two comics with whom I'm friends on Facebook who most, like, you're very fond of going, hey, what's this line from? And you'll have like 1,000 comments
underneath
it.
I just really enjoy it. And I think that the thing is, I think people think, oh, what could I do? It is social networking, but you've got to want to. You know, I do it because I want to, not because I think that it will help promote the Deering brand. And because you can't fake that up. You can't talk about rubbish for your whole life just as a form
can
of PR.
You
well, yeah, obviously you can.
Yeah.
But then the other, going right back to your question of how do you have a social life, you know, I am, you know, I'm in my late 30s. I mean, really late.
It's actually, it's your birthday in 2 days, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but this it's still, what, I'm still being my
you're
late
still
30s.
Still being in your late 30s, okay.
And I've, you know, I've got family. I've got a wife and two children. So between
yes,
that.
That's cheating as far and, as I'm concerned.
Well, it kind of is, but it also means that that's, between that and comedy, that is my social life. And yes. I'm into that, really. Yes. Every now and again, I think, oh, yeah, I should go to a casino. I don't ever think that. I don't know where that example came from. But never been. We should go. But
I'm
you
doing
know,
a gig in one in literally 2 hours.
Excellent. Enjoy.
Let's knock. I've done it before. Yeah. It's, the gig's nice, but you are in a casino.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah. I did one before, and it was very croupy, but I think your one will be croupier.
That's two. That's
working.
Two.
There we go.
So talking about the fact that you, as a comedian with a wife and two small children,
yes.
Pre-wife and two small children, how different was your approach to socialising with comedians? Did you do the hanging out after a gig thing then?
No, only in as much as you do when you're on tour anyway. I mean, I love that. That's the go, and us driving to Swansea is the nice thing is the middle ground, because other comedians you do have a shared experience, and so you can you're kind of automatically friends, uh-huh. and then that yeah. falls to the point where you actually are friends,
yep.
or you think, oh no, I'm with so and so this weekend, but you never. I don't know, and this is I think true. It's a bit like the more slightly more immature friendship you have, like when you are a student or people you live with and stuff, where you're just thrown in together and you see what happens. And that's what's great. I don't often find the time to socialise with comedians deliberately, and it's lovely when I do.
Yeah.
But really what's fun about it is just turning up in a dressing room on like Thursday night
yeah.
and thinking, okay, so it's so-and-so and so-and-so. Or particularly yeah. these days where it will be like off around the world, so you get to literally get to the airport to spend 10 days in Thailand, and only when you're in the lounge you're like, oh, it's going to be with that man and that man, and I know him and I like him and I've never met him before, but he seems a good guy,
and hey, I already know that guy, so maybe it won't be
exactly, and it kind of
I've got an ally,
and then you go and have adventures.
Just as a bit of background to you and your body of work and what have you, is which we haven't already done, you've been going for how long?
So kind of 10 years.
Okay.
I mean, I can be more boring than that. I dabbled. I've
be
always,
more boring. That's very much.
I've always
comedian podcast.
I've always done performancy things, and it was kind of a bit of a surprise that I didn't think of it earlier. I was in mid to late 20s, as I say. I'm very, very far into my 30s now. I mean, really, whoa! I can see the end. And then I got stumbled into stand up, and it was like, oh, I could do this. So I'd been warming up for it for a long time, doing
you were in a band,
theatre and education and music and acting and just anything performancey, mm-hmm. no proper jobs. And then so I never had that moment, which will come up,
yeah.
where people have to give up their life to go and do stand up.
I never had that either.
Have you ever had that?
There's certainly people who have. When I started doing stand up, I had no idea. I was from a theatre background and then a street performing background, and I had no idea that there were stand-ups who hadn't always wanted to perform their whole life, mm-hmm. and the circuit is absolutely full of people, isn't it, who were properly an accountant and used to make their mates laugh in the pub and went and got drunk one night and went, oh, I'll go for it, and then their life radically changed.
Yeah, that's right, which leads to this kind of epiphany moment, which yeah, we haven't had, because this is just what we fancied doing anyway.
So we're just peddling.
Sorry everyone. So, yeah, and then I dabbled, and then I started my first open spot. So I'd done a few gigs and thought, I don't want a hobby and it can't be my job. So I didn't, but I'd sort of had a toe in the water. But then I thought, no, I've got some better jokes now. I'm going to give this a go. And my first open spot was in the first, like, week of the year 2000. Mm-hmm. So actually, no, we're into, like, 11, 12 years now.
Okay. And were you, the point at which you went, right, I'm going to do an open spot, was that something you had to, did you book it in advance and then get nervous about it, or did you think this has to happen now?
I'm quite good at that. I'm quite good at making that phone call and say, I want to do this. And then the person says, yes, come and arrive at this time. And then after that, I go, oh, what was I yeah. But once, you know, it's basically a bit of split personality. I'll set myself up and then I can wander around panicking about it for weeks. It doesn't matter.
I think that's the only way to start.
One of my first ever open spots, I phoned them up. I was going through Time Out thing and I'd love to try this out. And I phoned up the Cosmic Comedy Club in Hammersmith, not there anymore. And that was a really tough You do you, that's bef- you
no, that was, no, that was before me.
Horrible. And
you it's go lovely that you can say that now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, that one was horrible.
Well, no, that's the nice thing. You don't realise that about being the thing about being an open spot is it's much harder than being a proper comedian.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
mm-hmm.
It really is, because people think, oh, it's terrifying, and they think, imagine how scary it would be to be in front of a room full of people like late at night. It's like, yeah, but a room full of people late at night are all expecting to have a good time. They've been warmed up by all the other acts.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go to like an open a new act night on a Tuesday or Wednesday. There's not very many people there, and they all expect you to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
And you might think, oh, it's okay because they're friends, and they'll be supportive. You can't be supportive. It's purer than that. You if it's funny, it's funny, and if it's not, and you're nice, then you just sit there going, oh. Not a good audience.
I did a clown workshop.
A clown workshop.
I went to the clown.
Eat that, Chuckles.
With a fabulous lady called Peter Lilly. Mm-hmm. And she has this thing about, she said, don't be a hypocrite. We had to frequently break off into twos or little groups. And she's like, okay, you be the audience, you be performing. And it's very, very important. Don't be a hypocrite. Don't smile weakly. Don't laugh to help your person along, because mm-hmm. that's not the reality of performance.
It can't be, because that, and that's a great thing about it, and that's why open spots are horrible, because really you've got these people who are trying to help, and that makes them act weird, and that's
that's totally right.
But anyway, it was a Cosmic, and I phoned them up, and this would be my first ever gig. It would be, I don't know, like longer ago, we're probably talking 15 years ago, and I phoned them up on a Tuesday. I said, I wondered if you've got any open spots, and they said, have you done any gigs? I said, yeah, I've done loads of gigs, which was a lie.
Yeah.
And they said, can you come tonight? I said, yeah, I'll come tonight.
And wow,
then,
nice. Yeah.
So then, that's, and you know, then I spent all afternoon, A, phoning my friends and saying, come to this gig, and B, making up some jokes, because I didn't have any.
Okay.
And then I phoned one of my friends, said, I want to do stand-up as well. And I said, well, they've got spots. I mean, she literally said, do you know anyone else? And I said, quick, phone them up, you could get a spot as well. And he phoned up and said, yeah, do you want any spots? And she said, yeah, what have you done? And he went, oh, I haven't really done anything. And he didn't get a spot. And he didn't bullshit or anything.
And in the back of Rob Deering's mind, some learning happened. <That's right. laughs> Hang on a minute.
And, you know, and obviously I thought that would be, and that never happened again, but it was it's a key moment. And that's always the way I've done it. And then it's like I do that now, even now. I'm on a tour. I started a tour yesterday, which is exactly that. I phoned up a bunch of venues. It's like my mini tour on the year when I don't tour. So I thought I'd phone up the nicest venues I really like.
This is your Christmas show?
It's my Christmas show.
Yeah.
And I phoned them up. No, so it's a Christmas show. So I phoned them up in, you know, early spring. And they said, yeah, come along. And then other me turns around in autumn and says, thanks. I just back from the Edinburgh Festival, and I've got to make up a brand new show in 2 months. You bastard.
Yeah.
So that's how
but I think that pressure, saying you bastard to yourself, God, now I've got to do it, means now you have to do it. And I think sometimes, we'll talk about writing and about making up jokes,
mm-hmm.
and I sometimes think some of the best writing I do is on stage, because I have to come up with something funny.
Yeah.
Far more so than if I'm sat in a room on my own trying to think of funny things. Even trying to think of funny things for half an hour and then ringing a friend and telling them, I suddenly put all these instinctive tags and punchlines
You've written something, you get on stage and you say it, and you say, I don't want to say this, I'm pretending to make this up. Whereas you're on stage and off stage voice really different. But I think it's more, for me, I think, again, it's different for different people. But for me, I think creatively, it's easier to answer questions then ask them. So like the blank page, when you think, oh, what shall I say?
Yeah.
Nothing ever is what the answer to that question is going to be. Whereas if you say, that's another reason why doing things like that people are cynical about, like panel games and things, is really good. If they give you a list of things to make jokes about and you have to have them done in a couple of hours, then generally, yeah, you might make up 30 jokes, but three of them will be great and you'll be telling them for years. And you could have sat in that couple of hours in your room going, and you wouldn't have come up with anything. Answering questions is easier than asking them. So you need to, as you get to writing from a sort of blank slate perspective, you need to fake it up. You need to say, well, I'll do a show about this. What's it about? What would be in it? And then kind of basically create spaces that you have to then fill in with jokes.
So let's talk then about your process going from, I mean, you're making a show at the moment. Your process is, you go, there we go, I'm at the blank slate phase.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? How do you wrangle things into existence?
I like that phrase, by the
Thank
way.
Thank you.
Give me a minute. I just need to wrangle some things into existence.
that's effectively how it works, isn't it? So you start, I mean, are you starting for your Christmas show? Are you starting with nothing, or are you going, okay, well, I know what the close is, or I've got that opener and I can adapt it? Or are you going,
I don't
right,
know. See, already well? I can. It's hard to remember. I mean, I have just written it. There's a lot of that creating opportunity thing, because you know, like you say, it's better to write on stage. Mm-hmm. So I'll come up with a comic idea and I'll think I will say something about that. So it's like a shopping list of jokes I might make up rather than an actual joke. But then other times you'll sit down and be all inspired and write for ages. Mm-hmm. But you'll rarely end up with something that sounds like what you'll end up saying. And yep. Also it always percolates. And that's true of everyone. Everyone will back that up. You write all this stuff and then 10% of it is good, but when you're writing it never feels like that. Of course you don't write something and then on that day think, well, most of this is rubbish. You think it's all brilliant.
Yeah. That's some of the most upsetting things when you go, I've got it, I've got this,
thank goodness I've written this.
This is incredible. Up and I you get. Write 3 pages of it and you go, there we go, and you get up and you can just feel it go, no, what was I thinking, how was I ever thinking?
It's different people,
any
of
this.
Different heads, and often sometimes you think, not only do you think that isn't funny, you sometimes think, what was the joke? What did I think was going to be funny about this?
That reminds me of the classic moment when, like years ago, I tried to write jokes with my friend Hutch, and we'd go, well, when are we funny?
So you'd run down to the car and you'd jump and slide across the bonnet. And
no high five for you. We would think, when are we funny? Well, we're funny in the pub. We're funny when we're relaxing. We're funny when we're having a drink. Got it. Let's get smashed and write loads of jokes. And then, of course, what happens is you look at the next morning, you look at it, you go, oh, we were brilliant. What notes did we write? And there's a piece of paper with lobster ? And you just, what was it? There was definitely something.
Yeah. And at that time also, you don't realise something that you come back to much later on, which is how much more funny something is for an audience if they know that either you've just made it up or it very much relates to them and the gig you're at.
Yes. Yes, we'll come back to that in a bit. But in terms of the process of you wrangling things into existence.
Yes.
So do you have, are you disciplined about, okay, now I'm writing time? Do you have an office? Do you sit down and go, right, now I'm going to write? In a week, what's your writing?
Yeah, no, I don't. In a week, I would let myself off. I allow a lot of time these days for circling. So I think, I'm going to do that in the end. And then eventually you get to the point where you have to do it and you sit down with it and you meant to spend a week on it and you do it in an hour. Mm-hmm. But as long as you're always wanting to and you're kind of circling the ideas, then that hour will always be valuable. Otherwise, you'll just end up sitting there thinking, well, I haven't got anything. And I don't have time in my life, and I don't know whether this is good or bad, but I don't, you know, I don't sit down at 9 o'clock every morning and write some jokes, and I don't go and try out jokes at new act nights or anything. Mm-hmm. I just generally try and, it's much vaguer than that. And the most inspiring thing I can do is find time to, because of the... I use all these pedals and guitar stuff, is to find time to rehearse. Mm-hmm. And then I'll do music without comedy.
I was just, and you that know, will inspire I was just me thinking to myself, jokes. This is great. You mean I don't need to get up and write jokes anymore, Robster? Oh, bollocks, you do music, don't you? You know what I mean? So you play music and you get inspired by doing music, or you rehearse, you practice music on a regular basis?
Yeah, more and more. Again, it's all about creating, finding the time to do it and having a mm-hmm. go at it and having a little thing. I mean, another thing is, in the way that I do comedy, is that I don't really hold with, I mean, other people do it and they do it well, but I don't like being the agenda setter. So there's only certain things I can talk about. I don't like saying, I'm going to talk about this. You can get on stage and say, so, castles, what about those ramparts? I could only do that joke if I was in a town with a castle in it.
Yes.
And that basic principle of needing there to be a reason to be talking about what I'm talking about runs through everything. There's no joke, there's no subject I can introduce and joke about, no matter how funny it is, unless it's already on the table. I mean, there's loads of subjects on the table. You know, first of all, you've got, as you said about me, there's popular culture. So there's all of popular culture. We all know Harry Potter, pop records, Christmas. That's why I've got a Christmas mm-hmm. show. We all know all about that. And then if it's going to get autobiographical, then great, let's do that. But it has to be kind of relevant. So I want to talk about the things about me that you're going to want to know about and things mm-hmm. like that. So basically it's all, there needs to be a Stuff that we should talk about rather than, I can't just pluck it out of the air.
Turn up and go, Nectar cards.
Exactly.
Go for it. Okay. So, but if something does come about in the audience, someone, you ask someone a question, I mean, do you chat to the audience? Do you ask questions? Or
Questions that can lead anywhere, but questions that would definitely get an answer.
Yes.
So not a completely open question.
Sure. You want for example,
on Facebook, I like asking questions like, which is the best da-da-da? Yeah. So there's always going to be an answer. I mean,
so people chuck things at you.
I would actually fill something in that duh, duh, duh is a, that's three dots. Yeah. I mean,
which is the best duh, duh, duh.
Three dots. I mean, what's going to be, what's a better duh, duh, duh than three dots? For goodness sake.
But, and you're hoping then that this, or you're expecting that this will stimulate some kind of interesting or provocative answer that then you go, okay, now there's something on the table. Yeah. We can have a conversation about
it. And also
it.
In terms of gigging, gradually over time that becomes material. Okay. Because if you make up something good or something kind of real happens, then you keep it. That's okay.
Sure.
And then there's other, again, adding in the music, there's things that are rehearsed, so they won't be made up on the spot, but it's nice to find organic ways of getting to them.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So something I'm doing at the moment, re-Edinburgh, I'm planning to do an Edinburgh show again next year. It will be my third one. And my take on the whole writing thing is I come away from the previous Edinburgh, and in September, or I have a week off, mid-September, I think to myself, right, I've got to start writing next year's hour now, because otherwise it's miles away, and what if I don't do it in time? So I need the longest possible run-up.
Isn't even you're absolutely right, because it takes ages. That 10% thing, always, you can't start late.
It's got to have the time to percolate down.
Yeah, exactly.
Or does it? I mean, there's a famous story of Phil Nichol writing his Perrier Award-winning show on the train on the way up.
Yeah, well, that's something.
Although he may have been percolating.
And I think he's kind of, he's like an artist. Who knows? Yeah, he's been circling. There's circling, and then there's percolating. Well, it's interesting. I have done quite a lot of gigs recently at the new comedy store in India, in Mumbai. Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting, because it's a really exciting place to do comedy, because it's just really good. It's all positive, because it's good and nice. And there's loads of people there and they like all the jokes. But on the other hand, it's a brand new comedy scene. So people are just excited about stand-up in a way that's just pretty much unimaginable in London.
Okay.
And particularly in London, as opposed to the rest of Britain, where sometimes people are saying, oh, this will be good. We're really excited about this. And you go, oh, you. So you've got these people, and they're up for it, and they're there, and they're an audience. But they're also like, oh, stand-up, imagine that. And if you're an Indian comic, then you can do jokes about, like, government or popular music or telly or films, and the moment you take the piss out of anything, everyone goes ah, because it's like the first time anyone has. So yeah, there's this kind of pure thrill ride element of it, and that's just, it's just great. And it means that when I go there, I try to think, oh, I've got to watch some films so that I can do some jokes about it. But the great downside of that, the sort of positive negative, is that you realise that on the UK circuit, you've got these basic cynicisms about stand-up that we all sort of touch on. Mm-hmm. For example, doing a joke about what you look like, mm-hmm. but doing like a meta joke about what you look like. So saying, so-and-so's let himself go, and that so-and-so isn't someone you look anything like.
Yeah. This is just for the benefit of the listener who may not have seen this, that happens. Something that is very, very prevalent.
And you could do that on stage in Leicester or whatever, and that would work well. Yeah. And you did it on stage in Mumbai, and everyone's like, he doesn't look like that person.
Good. There's a higher bar there. That's excellent.
And then things like negative things, like a little bit of commentary, or you didn't like that one. It's like they go, oh, no, we didn't like that one. It's just pure negative, you know. So you have to be positive. You have to just celebrate. And that's really good. But going back to the thing about writing and focusing down and percolating, is that you notice that all these really good new acts, they're sort of new acts because they kind of been doing that long, because comedy's just been invented, but they're good and they're doing 20 minutes in this lovely club, mm-hmm. but they're very different. There's they change the material a lot more. And often, in a not particularly, in a funny way, but they'll take a long time to get to a joke. And you notice that the positives about the UK circuit and the long kind of writing time is that you boil jokes down and you crack on and you find the good ways, the non-dull ways of being repetitive, of getting the same laughs in the same way day after day. That's what you get from long writing time and doing lots of gigs, is to be able to find the same quite neat little, hopefully hilarious moment and find it in the same way again the next day.
Can you, something I didn't ask you about before, was the possibility, can you give us an example of what you mean, something from your set? You needn't, I don't mean in a kind of a, hey, performing it way, but...
Oh. What, you mean something that I always say the same, that's always... that's,
well, yeah, that something that you either find freshness in it or something that's structurally different. Because I think it's an important point about boiling things down. There are certain formulae that I think it... exist in my mind that I think to myself, not as in kind of X plus Y equals laugh, but more there are certain rules that I try and follow. Like I might look at a situation and go, okay, and it's something Stuart Lee's been talking about recently, but you know, saying where's the jeopardy in this? Where's the jeopardy in this story? What's the danger? What's the excitement? You know, or things like putting the funniest word at the end of the sentence.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Do you subscribe to any things like that? Or do you
not
think it's
really
all...
I mean, I do, the only way I do that is I watch my, I see what I did and I try and repeat it. So I'll often take a joke I've done and try and make up another one the same. But
okay.
The first one, I didn't have any plan.
Sure.
So the only thing I'm trying to imitate is myself.
I keep spotting myself doing, that's like a cross between X and Y, and every time I do, it came out naturally the first time, and every time I do it since, I've had some really nice ones recently, but part of me goes, oh, it's formulaic, isn't it?
Yeah, there you go.
I found that, oh, no, I'm doing it.
No, but I don't know, it's difficult, isn't it? Because I like to, I mean, I will, if I can think of any, I'll tell you, because I think that the thing is, you want it to be fresh, but there are good way, there are clever ways of being fresh with stuff. You're, as long as you think it's good and you find it funny, and you're enjoying it and telling it in that moment, you can tell jokes that are really old. I think the best gig you can do is a gig that involves really old jokes, new jokes but that you've worked on for a little while, something that you've totally made up off the top of your head.
Yeah.
And I can't remember what the fourth one is. And any good gig
the fourth missed the secret ingredient that we never revealed to the public.
and I don't know, I think that, because I love improvising, but I think sometimes, you know, for example, when you're sort of starting out, some people say, oh, yeah, I'll improvise. And that's really good. But you kind of lose something by saying, that's what I'm going to do. What you need is something, is a kind of road that you're on, so that when you stray off it, everyone knows how exciting it is that you've strayed off it.
Yes.
Whereas if you're straying and that's what you're doing, it's like, well, now we're just straying. So you need the ad libs and stuff need to come up through the cracks. So you need to work on the bricks as well. And the other thing is that I do that gets you in a moment is I like to tell the things I'm saying to individual people, and that makes things that will make a line 10% funnier. If I remember to just tell it to someone and actually do it, not just fake it, it's not just eye contact. I that's something I do. If there's anything I repeat, is that if I feel like I'm hitting a punchline, I will tell it to an individual in the audience.
Now, that's something I would kind of group under stagecraft. And is that something that you think you've learnt through doing stand-up? Have you seen anyone else doing that and think, hey, that's great? Have you hit upon it yourself?
I've hit upon it myself. I don't know now. I've been doing it that long. I don't know how much I've been influenced by other people. I know that as a stand-up, I didn't come to it as a fan of stand-up. I came to it as a performer looking for somewhere to show off.
Gotcha.
So, you know, and I think to a large extent, I think that my persona, although it's changed a lot, my kind of onstage self was established before I wrote any jokes or did any comedy gigs from my old job where I used to fall over in pyjamas in European schools. So, you know, so there was a lot of crossover.
I'm sort of really fascinated by that, but obviously at the same time, I think it's kind of nice not to know,
I think we know
any
enough
other details about that.
That's enough. And so that's what led to my whole kind of, here I am, I'm going to do something stupid, I love myself, but I'm a twat kind of act, which I still do now, although it's a lot more, you know, I think it's a lot closer to me, but that is really what I'm like.
That's interesting that you think it's become closer now to what you're actually like. This is more honest, or you're more relaxed, you're more prepared to believe in yourself as being the funny thing. And
I think I just do less acting and just spent that much time on stage. You get less and less, but you emulate less and less, and it's more, I mean, I don't know. I think it's so hard. This you should ask someone else this about my act, but I think that, I think that I said, but because I think people,
can I ask your wife,
do I sound like myself on stage?
Yes,
and more so than I used to. She said, yes, definitely. And yes,
Excellent. I'm going to make a rule from now on for anyone I interview, they have to bring their wife.
Well, it's going to be difficult for some people.
Yeah, well,
they'll have to find
if they want
someone,
to be on the podcast,
get married quickly.
They've got to put the legwork in.
But I think, you know, because I always have this, but again, this is sort of paranoia, but I think in the nature, there's some, you know, this kind of cheesy pop culture kind of angle I have. I think a lot of times, and maybe earlier on more so, people assumed it was less honest than it is. I think you could also give an opinion on this. I think once you get to know me, you realise, oh, that is actually what he's like.
Yeah,
he does jokes that bad all day. but I think that superficially, ostensibly, my act looks a lot more considered, a lot more affected than it actually is.
I think that's right. I think there are elements of, and less now, absolutely, elements of you being cheesy that actually, having seen you years ago, they, even though it was more cheesy back then, there is still real warmth to it. And that, I think that's one of the things that maybe you don't know about yourself, or maybe you do, that whilst you're doing kind of cheesy pop culture, you know, when will the Queen die kind of stuff, and that's
that's got to be a week off work right there.
It's a lovely bit.
People don't really like it these days. She's got a bit old for that to me.
Really? Is that right? Has that joke not worked? Rob used to open by going, when will the Queen die? And it was just a wonderful, warm beginning.
Well, it certainly kind of set a tone.
Well, no, but that's my point. It may have been sort of cheesy and big and maybe a bit brash, but at the same time, the brashness was undercut by how warm it was. It was just a warm way to wish death on our beloved monarch, whom I would support with my life.
Yes, me too.
Yeah. So I felt briefly like we were living in a country where we had to say that.
I remember. Do you remember that podcast for the comedy scene that Stalin suppressed? And that was a great, good time.
Bad news.
Bye.
Oh, Jivio, thanks for coming. That's not a walkout. That was a pre-planned person that had to leave and made the effort to come despite that.
But a big royalist nonetheless. So. Yeah.
Where were we? So your honesty of you on stage, you feel you've become more like yourself.
Yeah, but I also think I always was, and I think it's just easier to see that now.
Yeah.
But going back to that's what I'm like, that's persona. You were talking about kind of joke form. I think that I probably, like a lot of, I was talking to another comedian about this yesterday, and he was saying he thought that we were from a kind of a sort of demographic where it's harder to be a kind of truth teller and say, this is this about this, because we were a bit kind of traditionally English and apologetic. And then we're into that, you know, that to be kind of...
So when you say we, do you mean
me
British
and
comics,
him.
You and this guy? Okay.
And we were kind of like middle class and English. And basically your first position is, sorry, that is culturally, that's my first position on anything. Sorry, you know, that if I was, working the UK circuit and like Australian or American, I could come on and say, oh, I think this. And that's like a natural position.
In an
to
accent
take.
That's precisely halfway between Australian and American. That was good.
But I couldn't do that. I'm not going to say, look, I think this. Sorry, that's where I'm coming from. So much of it becomes jokes about what you're not joking about. All my natural joke forms are all about the unsaid. I've got a bit where I do a song and then I just stop and it doesn't go anywhere. And the fact that it didn't go anywhere is the joke.
What song was it? I remember you did this. The last time I saw you was in Bristol at the Comedy Box.
It's Around the World by Daft Punk.
Yeah, I remember. You just sing it for a bit.
Yeah, and again, and I didn't. There's no way I could have written it. It's totally, I totally found that on stage. I had this idea. It was going to, I'd record it and then I'd use it for something. So I recorded it and then I stopped and I realised that everyone was thinking, right, where's that going? And I went, so, and I talked about something else, and it got this massive laugh. And then I thought, oh, well, I won't do the other thing now because that's funny. So I kept it like that. So it's nice. It's kind of basically this bit where there's no joke at all that kind of wrote itself. Mm-hmm. So it's just feedback. And that is really, that's what I want all my set to be.
Do you, when you're constructing a set, when you decide what you're going to do, or do you decide what you're going to do before you walk out, or do you just have a mass of stuff that's on your mind that you're gigging with at the moment, and you go, right, I'll open with my opening joke and then let's see what happens?
I think a lot of times I try and be the person who walks on and just sees what happens. Mm-hmm. But in real terms, you see what happens and then it's really good. So the next night you do it and it's really good. And then you end up doing that way round for months. Mm-hmm. And you have to introduce some kind of rogue element, some jeopardy.
Chuck in a bit of jeopardy.
You have to say, you're not allowed to do this tonight, or the guitar's broken, or this club have heard these jokes. And you need that to make you go back to the place where you go, I don't know what's going to happen. That gig you were talking about in Bristol, I went on in the beginning, and just the only thing I had for before I started playing the guitar was don't do any of the stuff you normally do at the beginning.
Okay.
So I just had
that's
nothing.
A good rule.
I just had do be funny for 5 minutes without doing any of the jokes you normally do. Mm-hmm. That was what I had planned for that night. And I think it was, I can't remember what I said, but the performance principle was what was useful. And you need that. You need the things, and it leads right back round to setting yourself up for gigs you have to do, like Edinburgh or whatever, that force you to have new material. Because otherwise you could just get your good 20 minutes together and do it again and again for the rest of your life.
I think there's definitely a dynamic. There's kind of a spectrum on which individual acts decide.
I've actually got like a Mac. I mean, spectrums these days are very kind of... always working.
I'll let the audience's sarcastic laughter speak for me. I think that you need to decide. You need to decide whether your primary responsibility or what is your responsibility? Is it to yourself as a comic to be running in new stuff and trying things out, or is it to the gig to smash the socks off it if you can? Which is a new phrase that I've made up.
Yeah.
Or is your responsibility...
Smash the socks don't really marry, do they? Smash the socks!
I think I started saying, like, smash the bricks out or something awful, and then mid-sentence, like, that's awful, go nicer. Yeah. So smash the socks off it. Or, you know, because another argument would be that your responsibility is to just absolutely belt the gig in order to start growing an audience and growing a reputation and...
Another thing you throw in, which is that you obviously, on the one hand, you have to always do great gigs. You never know who's in. There is no, that's okay, second-rate gig, that's okay. But on the other hand, you can't rely on your material. And you always will. And when you're worried about a gig, you always think, oh, what joke shall I do? And ultimately, the material is just a means to an end. And you have to always remind yourself of that. Mm-hmm. So if opportunity means you can't do these jokes... You know, oh no, I can't do those jokes. Those are my bankers. Those were going to be really funny. You have to go, oh well, I'll do different jokes.
Yeah. What's your opinion? What's your opinion generally, given that you're someone who's quite interactive with your audience? You like sort of asking questions and being on the fly. You know, those elements of free fall and crisis where you have to step up to the plate somehow. You have to answer the question.
There's a lot of negativity there, though. I never think of them as free fall or crisis.
Okay. Well, once again, we're learning more about me. Than you.
Yeah, I love risk of death. That's it. But I really don't. I'm not, you know, in life, I don't crave danger. I'm not extreme.
You went on Ultimate Wipeout. Total Wipeout?
Yeah. But that's not quite the same as jumping out of a plane. It's preposterousness.
Do you not think you're better in a moment of, maybe crisis isn't the right word, but do you know what I mean? It's like the equivalent being, if you write a joke on your own, it's actually funnier when you've got to step your game up. Or the fact we're doing this in front of an audience, as we were saying before, make us step our game up. So there is some pressure there.
Yeah, and also I think that's why you have to, and, you know, I stray into dangerous areas here, I think, but I think people have to watch the old comedy snobbery, because people are very into, you know, like very writerly acts who do very sort of interesting and challenging stuff, and often in a very friendly context. And I think you have to allow for the fact that the tough gigs, the kind of Christmas parties and the Stag and Hendus of the world, will lead to good gigs. I remember going to do a run of Christmas gigs in Brighton, and it was in Brighton and it was a comedian, so it, you know, this wasn't a horrific booking by any means. It's one of the nicest clubs anywhere, and they were good people, but the gigs were tough because they were Christmas parties and everyone was overexcited, and there was a lot of crowd control, and it was a bit like it was much more like being in a rodeo than normal gigs. And on the first night, I thought, oh, this is going to be tough. And I went out there, and pretty much, and there's a lot less sort of ad-libby interaction stuff, because all that energy is soaked up by telling people not to talk and taking the piss out of people and then getting back to the jokes you were going to do, which in turn have to be hilarious, otherwise they'll just shout you off the stage. So, but nevertheless, I go, I think this is going to be tough, and then you kind of ride the rodeo, and then at the end it was good. And then the next night you think, well, it's going to be even tougher tonight. And it was tougher the next night, but it went well and I handled the crowd and then it was good. And it went on that and it escalated and escalated, and I'm thinking, this is the night when it's going to go. And then in the end, you get to the end of a 3-night run, or I'm thinking of other gigs as well, or a 5-night run, in this sort of tough situation. And I suppose if even one of those gigs went wrong and someone had to get chucked out, or you got into a row with someone, then you'd have this terrible memory of the whole experience, the whole weekend or week in this club. But if you get through all of them, like that week in Brighton, and they're all good, and you feel like they escalated, even if they didn't, then you suddenly realise that not only it all went well, but they were as good they were more fun because of all that jeopardy and danger and challenge. It made you have to really, yeah, just work that much harder and hit all the jokes that much harder. And if you'd been in a theatre doing a run to all these people who liked you anyway, you wouldn't have had nearly so much A, fun, or B, difficulty.
It's a tricky one because I do think that that need to resolve a challenge can sometimes really benefit a gig. But at the same time, I've had the conversation with friends and with people after gigs who I didn't know, audience members, about heckling and whether that's ever a positive thing.
Yeah.
Because people can feel, you always get, you know, it's a classic thing in comedy, someone heckles you, you find it really problematic, they come, but you deal with it well, and they come up and go, hey, I helped you there, got your back.
Oh yeah, the real pain in the ass heckler will always come up to you after the gig and tell you that they were helping.
Even if
security have been involved and you've called them the worst names you know over and over again, or you've got the rest of the audience to bellow at them abuse on your behalf, they'll still come up to you afterwards and say, "So yeah, I helped you out there, didn't I?"
Yeah. So I mean, I try to dissuade people whenever I'm chatting to them socially. I always go, "No, no, we." I mean, I always say we would much rather we comics as a whole would always much rather you sat down, shut up and listened to all the stuff we've carefully crafted. But I know even as I'm saying that, that isn't the whole story.
It's not theatre. You know, and occasionally there'll be there's no right answer really, because absolutely right. You can't have interaction. It's a bit like in life when people say we believe in the right to protest, but really don't get angry and smash things up. It's like, well, let's not bother protesting. Yeah. This strike is going to be really inconvenient. Well, yeah, that's how strikes work. You know, and it's the same with people joining in. You can't have people just join in on your terms, although that is what you can plan.
That's effectively what you'd like to say to them. It's like, hey, I helped you there. Yeah, and do you know what? Every time you help me in future, could you have sort of subtlety and an awareness of the tone and the audience and all the rest of it? Could you throw things to, you know, if you want this to be a double act, it can work.
And ultimately, it will work okay, because you can, you know, if someone is an idiot, you can, then they'll show it. And if you're good, then you'll show the audience that they're an idiot. And then in the ideal world, they'll shut up. But even in an unideal world, they'll eventually get chucked out. And then, you know, and then other times people are funny, and sometimes they're funny at your expense, but they're still really funny and everyone liked it. So you've got to let that happen as well. And that's obviously very good for one's ego, because you're up there thinking, I'm the man, and then someone's funnier than you at your expense. Mm. You're like, oh, well done.
Yeah.
So win for you. And that's good for all of us.
In terms of...
It makes you feel kind of Rupert Murdoch humble when that happens. I feel really humble today.
Not humble.
But, yeah. Just actually really pissed off and I want it to go away.
Yeah.
That kind of humble.
In terms of people's opinions of you, and we're talking about ego and things like that, do you are you someone that subscribes to reading reviews when you go up to Edinburgh? Do you avoid them like the plague?
I am absolutely... I'm not on the fence, I would read them. But when it comes down to it, I thought people not reading them was a lie and was a ridiculous thing. And now I know that it's not true.
People avoid them, don't they?
Yeah, people avoid them. And it's the right thing to do. You will always remember them. The ones you hate will upset you. The ones that are positive, you still won't like, because reviews, particularly of stand-up comedy, are terrible. And I know this. I've done enough Edinburgh's... No, I've not gone to enough Edinburgh festivals and read all the reviews to feel that I objectively know that the reviews are terrible. You can't catch it. In fact, I don't think you can go to a comedy show and analyse it and see it clearly. The moment you start thinking, what do I think of this? You're a rubbish audience member. That's that, you know, because you need to let go and be free. Yeah. Fly like
so
a
the
bird.
The fact of someone having written a review means that they've failed.
Yeah, the fact that someone started to think, what do I think of this gig? That's when their opinion of the gig became invalid.
Oh yeah, love it.
But on the other hand, you know, it happens, it's part of the world, and even when you get a good review, you read these things, you think, yeah, but that's not what, you know, and it's terrible. But on the other hand, I can't bear not knowing. So the best one was 2008, when I didn't read any of my reviews, and I had a kind of system whereby they tell me if I was reviews, and I knew whether they were good or bad, but I didn't read a word of them, and I was protected from them. And then on the very last night of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, I got drunk and I read them all.
Nice.
Yeah, that's perfect. They weren't great.
Let's talk. We will just sort of ask to throw this to the floor if there's any questions. I'm aware now, because we're at the Top Secret Comedy Club in London's glittering Covent Garden, there are some people who have filtered in for the comedy show who don't know what this is. So can we have any questions apart from who are you and what's going on? Rob does a show called Beat This, which is a musical panel game, and our questioner was asking What did you ask?
How did it come about?
How did it come about?
Yeah, and how does it? Well, it's a quiz show. It's a pop music. It's a pop quiz panel game, and it came about totally externally. Someone came to me and said, "We're making up this pop quiz, and we'd like you to host it, but also to kind of make it up because it was very. They had a very loose idea, and they wanted me to do it, but me to do it to kind of come up with it.
I can't believe that because it's so you.
Well, that's it. I mean, I kind of led it that way because I talked to them about it a bit, and then we pitched it to whoever they wanted to pitch it to, and they said, "Nope, no thanks." but by that time, I'd made it up, so I made it up more, and eventually, I thought, "Yeah, we'll like work with them," and we put it on as I thought it'd be a nice way to do showcase skills beyond that kind of 20-minute set we've been talking about. So to be able to do a show which had lots of the musical stuff I do in it and also lots of talking and bantering and all that kind of stuff. And so that's how that came about. But then it's that classic thing, again, that we've covered, which is that we stopped developing it and I started just putting it on, mm-hmm. just as an opportunity to do it on stage. Not least because I don't think there's a nice kind of freedom with it because I don't think anyone will ever pick it up while Nevermind the Buzzcocks exists. Not in a bad way, it's just like that, you know, there's no need for another one. It's not the same, but that's fine.
But it does.
It gives it a freedom. It means it can kind of exist in its own sort of live space. And I love being working with other people. It's something is like going right back to the kind of touring thing. The other thing about stand up is that in performance it's completely solitary, and I don't want to be in a double act or anything, but being on stage and talking to other people is really nice. and I love it now it's nothing, all that development stuff has gone away, just doing it. And this Edinburgh, it was the best it's been. It was such good fun, and because that's all it is, it's beat this in Edinburgh,
it's
and it's just fun
for
everyone. It's off duty, you know, and that's what the audience knows that as well. It feels like something you do when you're not doing all those things you're supposed to worry about, and that was brilliant. But it's interesting how yet again with stuff that I like doing, it wasn't my idea, it just came from, you know, I like it's feedback again, it just came about, but I just nurtured it.
Would you please join me in thanking Mr. Rob Deering?
No, thank you.
So that was it. That's the first show. I hope you enjoyed it. I thought we got some great stuff out of that. I should say as well, I might have mentioned at the beginning, one of my plans with this is it be the sort of thing that people want to listen to on their way back and from gigs, to and from gigs. And if that's the case, then I would stress for acts that aren't being paid yet, for people that are still at open spot space, who are open spot space, open spot level, who are zooming up and down the country in the pursuit of something that seems like an impossible dream, but one day, should you pull it off, will soon seem like a very close-up nightmare. Don't be tempted. I would think it's probably sensible not to be tempted to lie about your levels of experience. Of course, I have to say that. I don't have to say that. I'm not the BBC. Do what you want. Lie. It's fine. That's the way lots of people used to get into it. But now, my God, there's so many acts. I'm sure people will get wise to that. So I want to improve. I want this to be as useful to you as possible, as much as I enjoy doing it myself. So send me your feedback, your questions, any recommendations for comedians you'd like me to try and track down and talk to, any questions you'd like them to be asked. Tell me if you think it's too long or too short. I might ignore you. Tell me if you've got loads of money to give me so that I can do this professionally. I don't need to do it professionally, but some money would be nice. That'd be good. Yeah, so random donations, that'd be lovely. It'd be nice to pay Dan. Dan Melrose did the music, and it'd be good to give him some cash. That'd be good. So send me emails and money to info@stuartgoldsmith.co.uk. And try and track it down. I guess we're going to try and get this up on SoundCloud and iTunes. Maybe that's somewhere where you got it from. And we will try and put it everywhere we can. We'll have a Twitter thing before long, but I don't know what it is yet. And there's also a Facebook page, the Comedians Comedian Podcast Facebook page. So have a little look for that. There's a link to that on my website, which is stuartgoldsmith.co.uk. So thank you, everybody involved in the making of it. As I said, Dan Melrose for the music, Tom Wateracre for technical support. He's fantastic. Mark Rothman at the topsecretcomedyclub.co.uk, and also that exists offline in the real world. So I thought I'd try and smuggle in the web address to save time in the title. But now, look, it's tripled the amount of time it's taken to describe it. Thanks to Pete Dobbing for his help, and also Asher Trelevin for creative assistance. And, of course, to Mr. Rob Deering for agreeing to be interviewed. And thank you to you for making it this far. There's now a lovely little bit of music to take us home.
Hey, Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.